I auditioned and ended up getting in by some miracle. I'm not really sure what happened. Why don't we just strike while the iron is hot? Why don't we make it COVID, make it during COVID, and then just get it out as soon as possible? Once that was brought up, it was a little bit of a sudden, like, all right, can we pull this off?
Was there anything like that for you, or a moment where you're like, this is the thing that I'm connecting with?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm going to get emotional. I'm sorry.
Sorrow Films is a production company that supports emerging storytellers with all aspects of independent filmmaking. On this podcast, we interview filmmakers about their practical wisdom and experience in an effort to demystify the industry. Today, we interview Stephen Meek, co-director of Recovery and co-founder of the comedy network JK Studios. We hope you enjoy. Awesome. what other interviews have you done? Were they with, it was all you, Mallory, Whitney?
Yeah. Yeah. We were all slated together to do a number of Zoom calls with people, all covering South by Southwest. So Shakya and some Austin based one, Lights Camera Austin. Mm. Yeah, there were, I don't really remember all the names, but. Yeah. Everyone we talked to was so nice. Yeah. Like, they were the sweetest people we've ever met. And they were all like, you guys made a fun movie. And we're like, thank you.
Yeah, how's the, I mean, it's been a couple weeks, hasn't it, since it premiered?
Mm-hmm.
How are you guys feeling?
Good. It was just really, really nice to get that energy.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, after.
Yeah.
Well, and especially, you know. Coming from a pandemic, right. I'm sure it's nice to have that. A lot of this, our audiences are really interested in like the details of filmmaking, you know, and like the process of it. And I don't think I've ever heard of what was a test screener length that a PR company sends out.
Oh, so like our just the film in its completed version, they just sent it out.
Send it
as a screener to different media outlets to just kind of get like the whether or not there would be positive reactions to it kind of thing. So it was, I mean, all of the lingo they used was new to me too, because it was like curtain raisers and toe dips and I don't know. It's just like sending the movie to people, seeing if there were anyone who kind of would champion it and enjoy it. And there ended up being a lot of people that really seemed to connect with it. The caveat has always been, you made a pandemic movie that was still funny. So like, we made a movie, and even though people have low expectations for it, I guess it's the feeling like, even though we're not expecting anything, you did a great job, kind of feeling. So it's been interesting. Yeah,
when we were talking, when Whitney and Mallory were talking about, you know, this is your first feature film, right? Mm-hmm. That you've written and directed, and I imagine this process has been the putting it into film festivals and going through all of that has been new.
Very
for you
new.
Guys
yeah
what no. What's it been like navigating that?
I mean, honestly, I don't know if we would have been able to navigate it very well without Sorrow. So much like we zero experience. We were just like, okay, filmfreeway.com lets you submit to all of these film festivals. Let's just send it out there. South by Southwest doesn't actually use Film Freeway. So we were like, well, we know we really want to go to that one. We know that we want to go. There's some maybe more international ones that we should try for. But it was very much a feeling of like, as soon as we were accepted to South by Southwest, that's when Scott and Abby and everyone like just... It's like, okay, now we're going to get this lined up, get a PR company. And the fact that I think the biggest boost to us was that South by Southwest introduced or I don't even know what to call it. It was like a teaser, the top eight
to watch for or something.
Not even like, not like a watch list, but like a, they just, when they announced the films that were going to be at their festival before they announced the slew of the other 70 plus films that they were doing. We were in a kind of a teaser list. So there were 8 films mentioned there. And I think that was made the biggest difference was people reaching out to us right away because they were like, oh, you're like an early mention from South by Southwest. So PR, sales team, all kind of came out of the fact that we were just mentioned in what felt like a little bit of an exclusive list.
Really? So, yeah. So your PR team reached out to you after that?
I think Soros used PMK before in other festivals and just loved working with them so much. So
cool.
He was like, we need these people now.
But I think that's really helpful for newer filmmakers to hear, you know, that there's people out there or organizations that do that specifically who can help you with it.
Yeah.
Well, I want to back up a little bit because I feel like you didn't start in film at all, right?
Nope.
Tell us a little bit about your beginnings in acting. In film. Well, I mean, I guess just in this industry, right? Because you originally started out as an international relations major.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the...
How did...
Yeah, A to B, you want to connect it for
us. Yeah. So when I was still a boy, my older brother went to Brigham Young University and he brought home a Divine Comedy DVD at some point.
Okay.
And Divine Comedy, the sketch group at BYU. He brought that DVD home and I was just like so enamored. I was like, this just looks like so much fun. I ended up going to BYU as well. And it wasn't really like on my radar. I enjoyed doing the school plays and the school musicals and stuff. I don't have a good singing voice though. So I was never like a big part of the musicals. I was just kind of like part of the chorus, having fun. I never really did any of the big high school acting roles or anything like that. So I came to BYU, and as much as I had enjoyed acting, there wasn't any like sense of, I didn't have the confidence in thinking that I was going to actually study acting or anything related to it whatsoever. And then there was a friend of mine that I had met freshman year who, Jenny Gray, she's now married to Jason Gray, who is a part of Divine Comedy. And she, I remember her writing me a letter at some point when I was in Korea for my 2-year service mission. So she wrote me a letter. I was like, Jason's in this group that's really, really fun, and I think you'd be a good fit for it if you were interested. And I got back from Korea and I like missed the audition, so I didn't even get to do it that first year I was back. But the next year I auditioned because I was like, oh, this is a group of people that it's not really about like the acting so much. It's very much about like the group dynamic and the energy and the audience and making sure that it's fun. So I didn't have to be a good singer. I didn't feel like I needed to be a good actor. Things like that. I hope that's not insulting to anybody, but it was just like this might be a good fit because it's just like a group of people that are very fun.
Yeah.
And so I auditioned and ended up getting in by some miracle. I'm not really sure what happened. But from that point forward, it was very like, it was just a school of hard knocks. I felt like you were trying to come up with so much material every semester for crowds of people, hoping that you'd sell out the auditoriums that we were trying to perform in. And yeah, that was really where I started like cutting my teeth on comedy writing and comedy acting, I guess, kind of stage acting and everything like that. And so I got in the summer before Studio C, the BYU TV show, started. So it was like a kind of slipping in the door as it was closing kind of thing. And so it just became a very intensive kind of process, like the 10 of us that were in Studio C became very tight-knit because we were just always trying to write, always trying to experiment with new things, throwing everything you can up against the wall and seeing if it sticks. And that gave us the confidence. I mean, 6 years after 6 years of doing Studio C, we all were like, I think that we want to try to do something new. I think that we've hit the limit of the opportunities and the kind of experience that we've got here. So we left En Masse and started JK Studios. And that was very much, it was another season of like intensive guerrilla type work, I guess, of learning how to do every job that we hadn't already learned in terms of, I mean, editing and production and every one of those pieces. We made a number of web series. We had people who were willing to part with their money to see if if we could make something good out of it. So we made some very fun shows. We made the first season of Freelancers, and we're very excited to make the second one coming up. But all of those things were really just like developing the talents that we didn't even know we half the talents weren't ones that we even really like wanted to develop, I guess. But it was like a somebody needs to, and we need the necessity of people learning how to edit and learning all of the just every step from a concept all the way to the actual release of a product. So JK Studios became that new crucible, I guess. So I'm very I think that recovery would have been impossible if we hadn't had like that kind of Studio C gave us the writing chops, JK Studios gave us the production chops, and then we were able to put it all together to make a feature in the middle of 2020.
Yeah.
The great pandemic of 2020.
Yes. Yeah, so you never really like saw yourself writing comedy. You just kind of got thrown into it with Divine Comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was that like trying to pick up those skills and just write comedy if you'd never done it before? You know, this taking on these new skills in such a guerrilla fashion, you know, I feel like that kind of has to happen at the beginning of a filmmaking career. And then it starts, there's almost like this pressure to specialize.
Right.
Which you've managed to not really have to specialize yet, right? Like you've been able to, you've just directed something, but you do spend a lot of your time writing, correct? And acting.
Right, yeah.
So are you drawn to one more versus the other?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, there've been plenty of dark moments when it's been that feeling of like, should we focus on something very specific? Should we just go full bore into one idea? Should I become a producer only? Should I become an editor only? Like those feelings of like, I don't know if we can keep up this pace that we've already have right now. So would it be wiser to try to like get very, very good at one thing instead of spreading ourselves too thin? But at the same time, I feel like knowledge in all the different categories of making film or writing, comedy or drama are just, there's so many invaluable lessons from literally everywhere. So many shining examples of people who are doing all of the aspects. Like I think of like David Bowie for some reason, and like the fact that he did like so much theater, but then so much music as well, and art. And there's just people who are incredibly good in so many areas, and I think it's because they are trying to expand themselves. They're trying to create situations that are pushing them to another level. And so the more I think about all of the like evidences that want to push me towards specializing in something, I'm more inclined to be like, but there's so many things, there's so many experiences that you can do. And honestly, just picking up the one that feels most exciting and most fulfilling or most expanding at any given moment feels like the path that I personally at least want to keep trying to do.
Yeah.
So directing has become a definitely something that I have really, really enjoyed. I only ever really directed a few sketches while on Studio C, and then a few of our JK Studios productions. So directing a feature for the first time was a very, just a very new experience, a very exciting kind of like, how is this going to work?
Mm-hmm.
How to, is it really just like the small version, like the 6 hour directorial experience from before, but just extended over the course of 3 weeks? Is it basically the same? And I think it actually is kind of basically the same. It's like you still have to hold all of the continuity in your head of like, oh, this scene needs to match this and the energy needs to be at this point, here, here, and here. But in terms of directing and writing and acting, there's so many opportunities. There's so many, there's just like so many different directions you can go at any given time.
Mm.
So it feels just exciting to do the ones that are presenting themselves
at the moment.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know, this is actually one of our audience questions, was how did you prepare to direct this thing? What's your process for preparing to direct?
Yeah. So I have a pen from Korea that I've labeled my Bong Joon-ho pen so that I can channel all of the directorial spirits. This was the first time I ever did this. It became a little totem of mine that I kept on set all the time because I was like, all right, I've got this pen and I've got this script, and you just make everything else up as you're going along, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure I'm answering the same question that you asked.
No, but, yeah. But, so you weren't brought on until after they had finished writing.
Like, I was definitely aware that they were like preparing this script. And at first it was very much like, we're going to just make this script for, just because we're not doing anything else right now. We're just going to write something that maybe we'll be able to film it a few years from now. Maybe we'll figure out funding to do it later. And then there was a point where they struck on the fact that if we made it COVID specific, then we would want to make it much sooner than now. And there was a little bit of a feeling of, should we go with this kind of COVID gambit? Like, is it really gonna, are people gonna want to watch anything in COVID? But are we also like on the front line of a slew of movies that are gonna be pandemic related?
Right.
So it was very much a feeling of, why don't we just strike while the iron is hot? Why don't we make it COVID, make it during COVID, and then just get it out as soon as possible? And so it was sometime in July. I think it was in July when we were looking forward and like, oh, the first festival date that we would want to submit to would be October 2nd. That was the late feature deadline for Sundance. And so we're like, if we set ourselves that objective, do you think that we can make it, kind of thing? And from that point forward, it was just a little bit like, let's just do it and not think about it.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, we made a pact early on that was like, if we're ruining this film, if we're ruining ourselves, like, let's just call it. But from that decision forward, it was a very like, we've got all these lessons that we've learned. We've got all these skills that we've been developing for so long. Like, this is the moment to like put them to the test.
How much of those conversations about going from, we'll just write the script for a future date to, rubber meets the road, how much a part of those conversations were you? I know, I mean, obviously Whitney and Mallory were talking about that as they were writing this, but you're there with Whitney. I'm sure she's talking to you about it.
I wasn't really keyed in until they brought up like the Sundance deadline. Once that was brought up, it was a little bit of a sudden like, all right, can we pull this off? We have to hit this deadline for writing. We have to hit this deadline for pre-production. We have to hit this deadline for filming. We need to give ourselves at least a month to edit the whole thing together, and get at least like a few screenings to our friends and family and such. so that we can hopefully submit a working cut to Sundance. Yeah, I guess I was clued in by the time they were like writing the script in earnest.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
You mentioned that this story is, it's very much Whitney and Mallory's, like they've put themselves into it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting. I think nowadays there's a lot of talk about like directing a story that's not necessarily your own. I guess that's always been the case, right? Mm-hmm. Like you've had to find something in the story that you can connect with, that then you can draw on as you're directing.
Right, right.
What was there anything like that for you, or a moment where you're like, this is the thing that I'm connecting with?
Mm-hmm. I think that it honestly all started out in more of a feeling of they can't do it alone. Mm. Like they need the extra hands.
Gotcha.
And I happen to be here and I happen to be free. And like both time-wise and money-wise, I'm free to do this kind of thing. And so there was that initial element of just like, oh, this is more out of necessity than out of like a true calling or connection to the project.
Right.
As soon as we were in the rehearsing and the rehearsing phase, though, it was much more of a feeling of like, oh, I might actually be even outside if all other things had been more in our control in terms of like funding or just time, all of it. Like I might still be the right fit for this because I've seen these two act for so long. We can get on the same page with each other very, very quickly when it comes to a creative vision for something. We kind of have developed our shorthand in terms of just communicating this kind of idea to each other and just, yeah, getting on the same page very, very easily. So it quickly became a feeling of like, oh, this fits so well because I know how they work. I know how they act. I know when they're forcing things. I know when the emotion is maybe in the wrong place. And I can actually just be a kind of a voice to chime in and be like, all right, let's just like slow down and you guys know exactly what you're doing and you're doing it so well. So let's just keep trying to get as much out of this emotion and out of this scene as possible because we all know what we're trying to get accomplished at the end of the day. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What was that like co-directing mm-hmm. with Mallory?
Yeah. Our co-directing experience was very much I would usually come up with a shot list because I'm not even positive to this day, like who is supposed to be in charge of a shot list? Like, is that an AD thing? I have no idea who's supposed to do that job.
I think it depends on the production. Yeah.
Okay. On our,
especially in independent.
Yes, yes. So I would come up with a shot list to cover any given scene that we were doing. Mallory and I would then basically go looking for the location, often the night before we were supposed to film a scene, and then just park and talk about what we needed to do, how we wanted to cover it, what ideas we thought worked, what didn't really like clarify and connect everything together. In our experience, comedy is very much about coverage and like the natural kind of interactions that you have with whoever you're in a scene with, trying to actually like hear what they say instead of knowing what they say beforehand.
Yeah.
And so our approach was very much just like, we need to be able to have long takes. We need to be able to get multiple angles of things because we're not really sure how it's all going to cut together. And so the co-directing was very much, it felt very much kind of like a technical covering of the whole film. And then when the camera was on, it became more of the keeping the energy natural.
Yeah. At one point all three of you were on screen together, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What, how did that go?
That day we had our unit director come in and do a bunch of things. Mallory, like, we weren't typically on camera at the exact same time. So Mallory and our unit director, Lane, would direct me when the camera was on me. And then when we'd flip around, it was Lane and I working on Mallory and Whitney. So that was a third person that we brought in to help us.
I think that that's another question, because you guys, it sounds like you kind of were all involved in the whole, even like the producing process, you know, the logistics of it.
Yeah.
And in raising funding. Mallory and Whitney talked about this a little bit last time, but what was your process for raising funding? How did that happen?
Yeah.
You know, once you guys decided we're going to do this mm-hmm. summer.
Yeah.
Where'd you go from there?
It genuinely, we started it out thinking, all right, we can get like 40-50K ourselves to try to do this, like just from our own personal savings and everything. We're just like, let's just like bet that we can make this movie with our own money.
Between the three of you.
Between the three of us.
Wow.
So that was the initial plan.
Yeah.
We then talked to our Whitney is really good at Photoshop. So she made a pitch deck that we then were like offering to different people, and like, you can give us like 5K and that'll be like, that will go so far in this movie.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. We were reaching out to different people to see who would be interested. So we had another friend of ours who was like, yeah, I'm happy to give some money to the film. My parents were like, sure, why not? They keep telling me that they were like, we weren't expecting anything to come back to us or anything. We just wanted to be supportive. That's very nice of you. Thank you. So we had people like, so we had basically just micro investors that were all like trying to make this movie. And then Babette Kelly as our production manager, our UPM. She was doing so much of the just like the actual production work in terms of seeing how we were going to make this budget, how we were even going to be able to pay everybody. Because we definitely did not want to be just like full, come do this movie for free for us as a favor and we'll defer payment and maybe you'll get something on the back end. We really wanted to, even if it wasn't like the most premium rate, we wanted to make sure that everybody felt like they were being taken care of in our crew, because that's always been the element that we're like hyper focused on, that we don't want people to ever feel abused by our efforts, because it's all just kind of like, it's all just vanity at the end of the day. Sometimes it's the feeling of like just making a movie because we think we're funny enough to do so. And so we just didn't want anybody to feel taken advantage of. And Babette Kelly, knowing Scott Christopherson, was like a godsend, because she was like, let's set up a meeting with him. He might be interested, because you're making the movie either way. And if he wants to sign on, if Soro Films wants to sign on, then that will just alleviate everybody's stress. And so we were, it was like our lunch break of the 5 days into shooting that we went to Scott's house and like pitched the movie to him. And he was like, yeah, all right, let's do it.
That sounds pretty anticlimactic.
Yeah, it was very much amazing. Like we, it was just the fact that we were building the plane. It was taking off.
Yeah.
We were making it midair. And then somebody was like, guess what? Okay. I've got an engine for you. And we're like, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So we were planning on it being so truly indie, so truly just like out of our own pockets. And and Soro Films in many ways kind of fell out of a blue sky to pick the production up.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what your crew members signed on thinking this is a small indie film. And then halfway through production, right?
Yeah.
So you 2 weeks of production.
Right.
You had funding come in.
We had the funding come in, yeah.
Yeah.
And we would have been able to pay everybody. We would have just been like, we probably wouldn't have been able to pay anybody for post. Would have ultimately been the problem. So we wouldn't have been able to pay properly for sound mixing or VFX or color. And we weren't paying ourselves already for like the editing and everything. We were like, okay, we can handle the editing, but everything else after that, we're a little bit like, maybe people will be able to do it for nothing. But Soro being able to fund so much of the film ultimately made it feel like, oh, okay, we've got everybody covered. It's not like the most expensive film by any means, but they saved us.
Being able to even think that far ahead, you know, to post when you're so in the trenches on like getting it made. I'm sure that was good, knowing that that horizon was was close and covered.
Right.
That's good. So you guys ended up editing it, right?
Yeah.
So
we were able to get our digital imaging technician to kind of put it all together in an organized way. And we had we had two assistant editors who were able to basically organize the whole film. Mm-hmm. And then Mallory took the first like 45 minutes and I took the last 35 minutes. And we just were like, over the course of, I guess we did it in like 1 week. We just were like, go every day, every night, for until we had like the whole film completed. But yeah, it was basically our editors did the our assistant editors did the organizing, and then we were able to dive into it as seamlessly as you can.
Yeah, well, like, it worked, right? You guys were able to,
against all the odds,
to get it together.
Like it worked, yeah.
Yeah. It's really exciting. It's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's a lot of work. And work-life balance, is it even a thing? You know, like, how did you guys manage that?
I guess when you're in it, it's a little bit of a feeling of like, I can do this for a short period of time. I know I can do this. Like, thinking about it now, it's not something that you necessarily want to replicate. But if it came down to it, you know that you're capable of it. Like, mm-hmm. I think back sometimes on like school and that feeling of like, how did I last minute write papers all the time? Like, if I try to do that now, I feel like I'd just be like so exhausted. And why did I ever do that to myself? But you're capable of doing like anything. It, like, you sacrifice sleep sometimes. You don't have a social life for a while, but like you're capable of anything. Like you can really, work-life balance, I don't even know if that exists in the film world when you're on a project. Literally everybody I know from above the line, below the line, anybody on a film project is like, this is my life for hopefully just for like a month, hopefully for just like 4 or 5 months.
Right.
Like you're able to do it, and then you get to relax and unwind a little bit after it's all done. So I think that's just what we relied on, was that feeling of like, we can manage this in the short term. And I think, I mean, there's probably a lot more progress we could still do in terms of divvying up roles. But when we're going into a filming project, we know like, okay, all right, well, there's so many things that we're going to take care of for the boys before it starts. And I'll handle meal prep, and you'll handle the figuring out the person who's going to be here on day X, Y, and Z. It feels fairly symbiotic right now, because we're putting fair play into action.
Nice. Oh, that's from the few people I've been able to talk to about this, because I think this is something that a lot of people think about, that it does come down to that teamwork.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. Yeah, that brings up a question that I had, but also some of our audience members had, is what, and in, not necessarily just recovery, but just in your writing, your comedy writing and directing, are there outside influences, you know, beyond comedians or films that have influenced your work? You know, does your background in international relations play any part in things you care to tell stories about?
I'm not keyed in enough on the film world to feel like these directors are my, like, my people. These are the ones that I can, like, turn to and be like, what would Paul Thomas Anderson do? And I don't necessarily feel that kind of, like, energy with anybody's work. I feel like, and maybe this is just still one foot in the sketch comedy world, but with sketch comedy, you can visit anywhere for, like, these brief snatches of time. So you've got one of the favorite sketches I ever did was playing a Roman emperor kind of thing, where we were laughing at somebody who kept, like, missing swings from a batting cage kind of situation. I loved the energy of just being able to, like, shout the classic phrase "bread and circuses," and having that be applied to such a, like, mundane, silly thing. But it, like, allowed us to, like, we were all in, like, this really epic Roman garb and a crowd of people shouting at this one person who can't hit a baseball. But, like, that feeling of being able to step into a world or step into a character gives you just, like, a little glimpse, a little snatch of just anything, whether it's the period, the person. So having one foot in the sketch comedy world, I feel like nothing feels like off limits in terms of where you can go, what you can take influence from. We've done noir sketches. We've done very, like, Liam Neeson action film sketches. We've done just the whole gamut. And yeah. So when it comes to stories that I want to actually tell, I feel like you can tell them through so many different forms, through so many different iterations, whether it was, like, an actual, like, we're going to go to ancient Mesopotamia and or you're going to go specifically into, I'm trying to think of a good example. There's the stories that I feel most attached to right now are honestly more family oriented, because I've got three little boys. They're like my 24/7 life and job, and so seeing the things that they really are excited about, thinking about making things that they would be really excited about, telling stories that are related to father-son dynamics, things like that are all very interesting to me right now. And yeah, I guess I don't know what the next story is going to be, but I feel like it's going to partake of those elements of trying to form close family bonds, trying to take care of people, because anywhere in the whole slew of history, you've got people trying to take care of other people, and especially in a world that feels like it's disintegrating in so many different ways, like it trying to create some lightness and levity feels like it's what I've been able to do for so long. It's something that I feel very confident in being able to continue to do. And as much as I love There Will Be Blood, I probably am not going to make any There Will Be Blood films, because it doesn't feel like it's in me, I guess. It's not my story or my message that I want to give out to people.
How, so you were mentioning that right now, that's kind of where you're drawing, I guess, in a cliche way to say it, drawing your inspiration from is your experience with your sons. Is there something in the works or that you would like to do coming from that area of your life?
There are two very specific projects that I, like, think about that I'm not even sure what the path to making them even looks like.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is actually a sci-fi film about cloning that would involve, oh, I'm going to get emotional. I'm sorry. It's not even a real story yet. I haven't even like written it or anything, but I'm really sorry.
No, it's okay.
Maybe because I haven't really like talked about it with anybody before. So I haven't, it feels like,
yeah, really personal.
I can't get it out. I'm sorry. Yeah. Let me just like, sorry, I'm laughing so much too.
No,
just trying
it's
to
good.
Like break out of the emotion for some reason. I mean, do I look remotely composed right now? I don't.
Look at me. You look great.
Okay.
Yeah, you're good. You're fine.
A movie that I love watching with my boys. Paddington.
Mm.
Paddington 2. Those connect so well to me because it feels like, I mean, Paul King having directed The Mighty Boosh, which is a very sketchy kind of sitcom. I feel like would just be, that's like, he's already filling the niche that I want to fill. Like he's like making such wonderful comedic stories that are more family oriented with a beloved children's character. So there's a movie called, oh, what is it called? It's like The Snowman. I think it's just very simply called The Snowman.
Okay.
Have you seen this? It's like this British animated film that's like done in colored pencil from like 40 years ago or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I remember.
It has
this
amazing
about.
Song in it that's like one of the best songs I've ever heard.
Okay.
Walking on the Air. Walking in the Air. Anyway, I was like, if we could make The Snowman Paddington style, that would just be the best thing. Like that's one of the projects that I really want to do.
Yeah. That sounds really wholesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really great.
The other one is, yeah, sci-fi cloning a lost child. So that's as far as I can probably talk about it without getting too like worked up, I guess.
Okay. But,
yeah.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
Well, I'll keep a watch out.
Cool.
Those.
Who knows? Yeah. They are maybe like a decade down the line because I don't even know what the path looks like to get funding to make anything like either of these movies. I assume The Snowman and Paddington, like I don't even know what the VFX budget for Paddington is. And
right.
How do you even like tackle that without a major studio behind it? It's just like the sci-fi one might be a little more manageable. So. I'll let you know
who'd
when the script
that,
is finished.
That, yeah. Who'd have thought a sci-fi would be more manageable than...
Right. I guess it would
Paddington,
be... Because it would be more in the line of, like, Her or... I mean,
right.
Deus Ex had... Or Ex Machina? Ex Machina had more... definitely had a lot of VFX in it, but...
Yeah.
But that energy, that, like, small cast, futuristic world kind of feel.
Mm. In the short term, looking for the next few years, where do you see yourself and JK Studios and headed? Where do you see yourselves headed?
I guess anywhere the wind takes us at this point. Freelancers season 2 is happening, which we're all very, very excited for. We just loved making the first season. And so it's great to revisit that. We were just having a conversation the other day about kind of comparing Fleabag season 1 and season 2 and how like they're the same world and the same character, but they felt like such different stories and different same character at different phases in their lives. And so we were talking about, does the future of freelancers in particular need to actually be like forever this very kind of, it's not slapstick, it's just absurdist and just kind of just off the wall, very sketchy kind of sitcom, and if it could ever transition into a more like character driven not a drama by any means, but like character driven very connective kind of story rather than just like what's another random thing that we could say now. So I like the idea that freelancers could actually be a project that evolves and that has staying power because it has good bones. It has good, like, versatility within it.
Yeah.
But outside of that, it's a little bit like, I mean, you just keep writing and you keep dreaming.
Yeah.
Keep hoping for the next person to, and hopefully if you're just doing good work and treating people well, that more opportunities will keep appearing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, maybe that's somewhere where we can end is asking how, you know, from your experience starting in Divine Comedy, you know, now you're part of this network that you've, JK Studios, that you've helped found. What advice would you have for filmmakers, especially like regional parts of the U.S., of getting to that point where they get to just start thinking about things and creating things? I mean, I don't know. That's kind of a roundabout question or like a really wordy question. But like, yeah, what advice would you give filmmakers who are just starting out, actors who are just starting out, you know?
I guess I would say that you don't work in a vacuum by any means. Like you are always going to be working with and relying on others. So finding a team that you love is huge. My personal experience, I feel like I can't help but think that some of the most watershed moments of my life kind of happened in a blue sky kind of way. Like they just like came out of nowhere. Like I was on a path and I just like did a random opportunity or a random chance and it ended up shifting so much of what happened. Like getting into Divine Comedy is one of those things to me. Meeting this group of people, meeting the group of people that I eventually married, one of them, and like all of these different things that happened. Like, so I guess just being very open to new experiences, because you literally have no idea which path it's going to take you on. And then it's a very difficult thing, and I'm not perfect at it by any means, but treating as many people along those paths well as you can, like just never truly knowing like who is going to be able to give you an opportunity later, or even if they don't give you any sort of opportunity, like what kind of impact you can have on other people's lives. Like you definitely just trying to live as open to experience and as open-heartedly as possible, I feel like is the best advice I could give, because I don't.
Yeah.
It's at least the advice that I'm trying to give myself constantly. So as much as there are like difficult people or difficult things, injustices that happen, resentments that arise, like you can really only control how you're living your life and how you can extend forgiveness and generosity to others. And that generosity often just comes right back.
Amen.
Amen.
So true. That's definitely true. No, I think that's really, it's not only is it good advice, it's good practical advice, you know? It's so true. Thank you for talking with us today.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Thanks for being
really good.
Thanks for being open to having me here.
Yeah, I feel like I've learned a lot. I feel like I always do, though. I'm the lucky one. I'm still starting out as a filmmaker. And so getting the opportunity to sit in a seat across from people who've been through the fire, the crucible, you know, crucible. are willing to share with us our experiences. We really appreciate it. So.
Of course. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily, it's weird because I know I said that it is a crucible, but at the same time, it doesn't necessarily feel like there's any like significant experience that I've had or it's just the fact that you're taking every day one day at a time and you're ending up with opportunities that you make the best of whenever you can. So
yeah.
Well,
thank you. We appreciate it.
Of course.
It.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. To find out who our next guest is and to stay up to date on all of our projects and announcements, follow us on all major social media platforms, at Soro Films. What makes this podcast distinct is that we put you, the audience, in the driver's seat. Influence the conversation by submitting questions for our guests ahead of each episode via Instagram. Soro Films helps in all aspects of the filmmaking process, including funding, production, marketing, and distribution with a focus on emerging feature filmmakers. If you're developing a project you'd like to pitch to us, you can submit it at sorofilms.com/submissions.